more sophisticated audience. And I think this ties into the next question. When would you use weighted Q versus age year or unweighted? I think it's important when you're doing models or analysis like this to consider all of the inputs. Consider the data quality. Okay? How sophisticated was the data collection? And how precise is it? What is the nature of the models that you're using? Are they simple parametric models or even simpler than that? Or are they sophisticated science physics-based models or empirically validated models? If you have, in the case of AHP, often used in marketing, you have rigorous methods to collect information, and you have a number of different features, and maybe you want to differentiate between different consumer groups or use cases. In that case, if you have good data, you have maybe well-defined models, and it's worth the extra effort to go through AHP, because you have a little bit more power in differentiating the groups and predicting what one group would like over another. If you have really kind of not very rigorously elicited data, then and your models are simple, then why go with the extra sophisticated process? The underlying information that you have is a bit sparse, and so this gets you going in a direction you will want to eventually use more sophisticated analyses with better data, but you're again trying to prove the trade case that you're exploring and focus in on the few promising candidates. So any lingering questions about that or other things from our discussion on last Wednesday? Okay. So interfaces can be a significant source of value in a system. If you think about it, when you decompose a system and go through the allocation process, you're creating interfaces. You have elements, that's the definition of a system, you have elements and interfaces. We focus on the elements a lot because that's where we think the functionality is coming from, but a lot of the functionality actually is coming from the interfaces because there's a process that's usually happening across the interface. And because there is there may be a boundary between one element of the system and another element. Think about, are these created by different engineers? Are they different design teams? Are they using different technology? Do they reside in different organizations? There's crossing the organization boundary. Is the interface with your user? A lot of value is created, but because of those handoffs, there's a lot of opportunity for problems, misunderstanding, and so forth. So we really want to clearly identify what are the interfaces, what's passing between them, what's the handshake, if you will, between one side and the other. And then they become part of the systems engineering process. So we'll have requirements for interfaces. So we'll define requirements. Ideally, we assign someone who's responsible for the most important interfaces. And we go through a verification process and validation process for interfaces. So all the things we've been talking about that are related to components, we may replicate with interfaces themselves. And then there are strategies. If interfaces are potentially problematic, you can say, well, let's get rid of them, just like Elon Musk wants to get rid of parts of the system. He might want to get rid of interfaces. And in fact, so like in Tesla with their, some of the newer models that are coming out, they have this process called the gigapress, where they, rather than having a built-up chassis made from many parts that are either welded or fastened or something like that, assembled, you have a single injection casting that, or half of the chassis. And it's, you know, kind of new technology, but all of a sudden you've created one part where many parts used to be. And you can also create interesting shapes that assist other parts of the system. And this is why, you know, whenever there's a competitive threat, Tesla lowers their price to meet the competition because they can. They've reduced costs by reducing interfaces and parts numbers and things like that. Probably not cheap to create that operation, but it's an example of why we might want to reduce the number of interfaces. And when we talk about complexity, that will become even more important. So you've heard from Ed previously about interfaces, and again, we have the operand and we have a process, and the process often may span a boundary. In order for the process to occur, you go from one state to another state, and we want the interfaces to be compatible. So this is continuing from that discussion. So there are four canonical types of interfaces that we typically know. The number isn't just limited to four, but these are the four main ones. First of all, there's a physical connection for a physical product, and this connection is always symmetric. So if part A is made into part B, then both are touching each other. And in the electromechanical world, or the physical world at least, physical connections are dominant. So you can think about fasteners that hold two pieces of material together. You can think about stakes, not the meat kind, but little tab that goes through and you mash it down like a ribbon. Welding, other joining, cooling, adhesives, that sort of thing. Okay, so that's a physical connection. Energy flow. Okay, so energy is flowing from one place to another. And so an obvious daily occurrence example would be, the electrical system that we have in a building like this. We have electricity that's connected to outlets, and we can connect our devices to that outlet, and that's another connection, and what flows between them is energy. Mass, so I showed you the example last time of the a petroleum tank farm. That's an example of mass flowing. So you have oil that's being loaded from a barge going into a tank, and mass is flowing through that interface. You have air handling systems in buildings where you're exchanging massively, in this case, air. So something is flowing across the interface. There's a change of, there's some kind of momentum you can characterize. Finally, there's information. Okay, we have data, we have signals. We look for Wi-Fi connections when we get into a building so we can catch up. We hope our phone is connected, has a good signal, because we want information to pass across that interface. Okay? Here's some examples of interfaces. Let's walk through them. So we have, in the case of, say, the petroleum tank farm, we have a valve, and there's some mass flow that goes into a tank. Right? So that's pretty straightforward. That correlates with the canonical mass flow interface. Okay. Next one, a rocket. You think of a Falcon 9 or a space launch system. Rocket has a payload on top, and it is imparting momentum because you want the payload to change from zero velocity at the ground to a certain velocity for orbit or for a translunar injection or off a planetary mission. So you have the force over time that changes the velocity of that payload. And the interface between them is usually a physical interface. And there are standard docking adapters. And you want that interface to be nice and solid while it's riding along, because there's a lot of vibration, a lot of force. And then you want it to unlock and let the thing go, which sometimes doesn't happen. But you have that interface, okay? Heat exchanger. So So air conditioning system. We have a refrigerant and the, you have some kind of heat exchanger, so it's usually a bunch of tubes or fins or something like that. And as air flows over the cooled tubes for with the refrigerant, you have a transfer of thermal energy. And so that's, in thermodynamics, we call that heat flux. Okay, so the incoming air is warm, it has the energy removed, or the temperature, as we measure it, as on the outside, outgoing side. And so that's the change of state of air. Let's talk about a website and a browser. Who knows a lot about websites and can tell me, you know, how this is maybe correct or not correct? What happens when we interact with a website, whether it's on your phone or your computer or whatever? What is exchange? Mohammed, what is exchange?
I'm not an expert, but I think the HTML code of the website that you're trying to access is exchanged to your browser, and then it gets translated to the front end of the website.
Okay, so there's potentially some code that's being passed. What else is being passed when you interact with the website? Siddharth?
Yep. So the browser makes a request for the given URL. Yeah, if you want to even go further in this step itself, there's DNS and all of the other ways in which the address gets matched. Then there is a response that is sent back, which that response does include the HTML file. And the browser code knows how to render the file as, you know, the rich text that we see in the browser.
Okay, good. So there are actually a number of transactions that are taking place, and how you want to define the interface really depends on is it at a high level where you talk about a click of a mouse or a touch on a haptic screen and the server responds, or, you know, do you want to get down into the details, because, you know, there are things like cookies and other things that are being exchanged, and maybe they reside in different locations, and, you know, there are calls back and forth across a network. All right? NPR radio and listener. What's the interface? Moshe?
So to me, the radio itself is the interface, and information received from the station is the information get passed over, and the listener could, by tuning the channel, to select different channels to listen to.
Okay. Juliano, you had your hand up, but it's not up anymore. Did you? Delta? Okay. Lal?
Yeah, I think the antenna is the interface from radio to station to the host or the reception at the listener's radio. So I would say antenna is the antenna.
Okay, so you have a number of interfaces here. So you have a broadcast antenna, and you can even go upstream from that to the transmitter and amplifiers and things like that, energy source. But then you have...
Satellite. I incorrectly told antenna. It's a satellite, I mean. I'm sorry for that.
Okay. So you have the antenna, then the antennas are exchanging, so there's an electromagnetic exchange between antennas. And then you're in your car, you have the radio, and the radio converts that electromagnetic information into a magnetic signal, electric signal that powers speakers, and the speakers convert the electric energy into acoustic energy, which then travel to your eardrum, and that is converted into neurochemical Dennis, you had your hand up.
Yeah, I guess you were just getting to it. I mean, I'm not sure whether to think of the interface, and maybe we're getting to this later, but the thing of the interface as kind of the formal elements, right, that make up like the transfer of something from A to B, or if it's like, to me, the interface NPR to listener would be like human language, right? Like something,
yeah.
And you can do it, like an NPR radio could be transmission to a listener a few different ways, right? Formally, but functionally, it's always the language that's being sort of heard by the listener.
Yeah, so why am I choosing NPR as opposed to Modern Country or talk radio or something else? You know, there's something about that that's interesting to me, and it's the content of the message. So when you're dealing with people, maybe the interface, there's certainly something that can be engineered, but there's also something that can be designed aesthetically, intellectually, emotionally, that passes, is conveyed between, you know, the broadcaster and the listener. Right? And those are the things. As engineers, we would certainly want to make sure the technical components work. But then there has to be some part of that signal that's worth to the user to connect. Right?
Yes. So when we were doing the system architecture as an engineer, we always draw this system boundary. Mm-hmm. We also have to do the same thing for the interface, because during this discussion, we've heard that on the other side of the interface, there's so many pieces moving. But from the systems perspective, do we care about all of these pieces that are moving? Should we draw boundaries that focus on certain elements on the other side?
So you do have a system boundary, and the system boundary is sometimes for your protection, you from having to deal with too many things, right? And the system boundary will have interfaces. And you definitely want to characterize those interfaces. And you want to know what's on the other side of that system boundary. What's the other part of that handshake? And if you don't know enough about it, you might want to learn more, because there could be some problems. Ideally, you'd like to have that other entity on the other side of the interface be well-defined, well-known, and stable. But if it's not, then you might want to explore that, and you know, if what you find is concerning, then you might want to think about redrawing the system boundary. Okay. All right, so here's an example of an interface, of a system that has a lot of interfaces. This is the Florida Department of Transportation, specifically it's looking at District 5, which means nothing to any of us, but it's a geographic district in Florida. So the intelligent transportation system helps people get to where they need to go. It has a number of functions. It manages traffic. It provides updates for, you know, accidents. If something is happening, there are closed circuit cameras. There are inductive loops in the ground that measure traffic speed. If there's a hurricane or something that goes through Florida, which happens. Sometimes you want to, instead of having, you know, four or five lanes flowing in each direction, you want to have 10 lanes flowing away from the hurricane. Okay, so you're going to reconfigure the highway to, manage evacuation. So there are a lot of functions that are built into this. And it's not only the physical infrastructure, so you have a lot of sensors and communication lines. Those are important. But there's a lot of software involved. Okay, so Florida uses the SunGuide software, and it has an interaction with users. So you can download an app to use the software. It will connect with different types of software, either at the district level or at the Florida Turnpike Enterprise level. Okay, so you have Express Lane software, SunGuide software, you have different districts, like adjacent districts that will need to connect, all right? And these are softwares that have been written by different vendors and at different times. Okay, so there's an interface between one software language and another software language. Right? And you've got to coordinate all of that. There's also the back office, which handles billing. Right? So when you go through a toll gate, then that's a transaction that needs to be recorded and assigned to your account. So you can see that the number of interfaces for a software system are at least as complicated as the interfaces that are associated with connections to power, and sensors, and other things. So interfaces are a challenge in a lot of different places. Let's talk about an ATM. So there was a pretty simple video that I asked you to watch to prepare for a discussion today. I think we all kind of know how an ATM works, but there's a lot going on behind that screen. And I specifically asked you not to focus on the human-machine interface, because that's the one that we're most familiar with. So pick an interface that you thought about when you watched this video, and tell me about it. What was its function? What was the form on each side of the interface? What was going on at that interface? Right?
So when I watched the video, the first thing that I thought about was the physical layer, in this case the modem, which translates instructions or commands from the user to the internet and back and forth. So for me that was, I would say, the most important interface.
So what's happening at that interface? What is being passed?
So if I remember correctly how it works in the internet, it's a set of instructions that are sent, and then another set of instructions.
Okay, so there is information being passed. And then there's also some power associated with that. It's low voltage, but it's still some power that kind of moves the information along. Okay, so modem to internet. Bernardo, what interface did you focus on?
So I focus, based on what you just said, like I can see how what I was focused on, it was probably wrong, but I focused in the interface of like the ATM with the bank. I was thinking, okay, the function is to, like, I listed several, like, it's like first to confirm the identity, second to confirm the balance, third to report extraction. But I can see based on what he was just saying, how in reality those are probably two interfaces, actually, the ATM through the modem connected to internet, and there's internet connecting to the bank instead of what I was describing.
Yeah, so that connection to the bank is important because that's what money is, right? So what is important about that connection between the internet and the bank? What's flowing there and what are the functions that are involved?
So I think what was flowing there was like queries, most of all. So the bank basically making a query about the identity, a query about the balance, and then a push notification of like, okay, here is a reported extraction. Kind of important information, I guess, like basically a query receiving back information.
Yes, and can just anybody access the bank and find out more information?
No, to be like actually like the identified person.
Yeah, Eugenia, what interface did you look at in the ATM system? Yeah, and that chip interface is pretty important. It's the one that we care about, right? Because we want the card to work. But it's got information that can be read. The chip has to be in a specific location because you want the chip to be over the sensor or however it's interrogated. So it's got a physicality to it. And then the information embedded or encrypted on the card should have certain format and levels of security. Okay, good. Bijan, what interface did you look at with the ATM?
I picked the distributing money interface. So between the cassette for cash and the tray that dispensed the cash on the ATM. And so it seemed like between those there would be a physical interface of actually moving the money from sort of its storage area to where a human would take the money. And then there are probably likely several checks between the electronics and the control board system to validate that, you know, the appropriate money has been distributed and that money has actually left the tray.
Yeah, so that's a pretty important part, because we go to the ATM to get money usually, and the bank doesn't want to have ATM spewing out $100 bills or bills stuck together. And so the physicality of that is really important. And you know, that's gonna affect our experience. They just work. I don't think I've ever had a problem with an ATM not working. But somebody thought pretty long and hard about how do we make sure that cash gets dispensed properly. Okay, good. Other here in the room, yeah, please, Francisco.
Oh, the motherboard that creates this specific and unique code, EMB, I think, code, and sends it through the I/O board to the modem. They say that it's a unique number for each withdrawal or deposit, and they send that data with the PIN to approve the transaction.
Yeah. So in security systems, sometimes you'll have a separate element that handles encryption, right? And so that's an important part of security, and you want to have that connected to inputs and outputs. It's essentially a gatekeeper, a control. So that's really important because, you know, the bank doesn't want to have a backdoor into their financial system for all sorts of things could happen, right? Okay. Jacqueline, last comment. What interface did you focus on?
Some of the ones I already mentioned, but specifically with the money and the cassette and then the tray, one thing that got me thinking was just, to your point, like I've never had an ATM I use that didn't have cash, but there would have to be some thought put into how do you know if you're low on a certain currency in order for the ATM to actually function. So there'd have to be some sort of logic, I would think, with requesting, you know, X dollar amounts, assuming this is a US ATM, and then if the funds are like getting depleted there, where the ATM wouldn't function, and then having thus a maintenance plan to work on that, so.
Yeah, great, so maintenance. There should be some kind of signal sent somewhere to say, okay, this ATM is down, this ATM is being burgled, this ATM is running out of cash or running out of slips for receipts. So please come, or our vault is full, please come empty it. There are all sorts of signals that you might want to send to the people who provide this service for the system, okay? A lot of hands up, thank you, good comments. So I think a general question is, all of these seem like they're important. You definitely want to track them all, or at least define them. Are some critical enough that you would want to assign some person by name, perhaps, to manage that interface? What do you think?
Yeah, I'm sure there's a whole set of people managing the requirements for the crypto interface, you know, check and balance or higher level.
Yeah. So, we probably wish there were more people assigned to cybersecurity. Good career field for those of you who are interested. But yeah, so there you would want to manage the interface involving security, and specifically who would the interface manager probably be working with?
I'm sure there's federal regulation as well as like bank regulations, so if I'm an ATM provider or third party, I have to work with banks to ensure compliance.
Right. So regulators, probably banks themselves or banks as an industry group. Card makers, manufacturers. You might want to understand the pathway that the signal takes to see if that can be intercepted or somehow, I don't know what the formal term is, but people like to kind of break into the pathway and snoop or sniff the information that's passing along, okay? Other interfaces that you think are worth keeping track of? David, online?
I was just going to say, the bunch of the talk was about the EMV protocol specifically, which is like what governs the smart chip in the cards, more than just the cryptography, but how they all talk. So like you can take any credit card from any bank, including any ATM anywhere in the world. So I think that seems like an important interface, probably beyond like a single person. I think you hit the nail on the head with like industry groups, regulators, and then potentially like non-industry kind of trades. Standards like ISO or something like that. I don't know what in this industry would that would be, but and then that would yeah, affect the banks, the credit card manufacturers, the ATM manufacturers, and then users probably the different like stakeholders of the standard.
Very good, thank you. So those of you in the U.S., you know, about I don't know how many years ago it was, but we went from transition from magnetic stripe on cards to a chip embedded card. And Europe had made that transition many years before. But you know, the standard may change. Something as ubiquitous as a chip on a card, you probably don't want the standard changing very often, but you want to make sure you know when it does. Or if people are thinking about changing it, so that you can influence that standard. All right, very good. So let's move on and talk about ways to represent interfaces. So, a system can be represented as a network. You have nodes and you have interactions or pathways between nodes. And those pathways are what we're talking about today, those interfaces. So you can look at a classic network diagram like this, and those make great graphics for publications, but it's kind of hard to understand what's going on in them because they get really complicated. And so DSMs, which I think you've been somewhat exposed to so far, are another way to represent networks. Okay, it's a 2x2, well not 2x2, it's a two-dimensional representation of networks. And the way you typically represent a DSM is that you have, in this case, we have eight elements in the network, A through H, and by looking at the matrix associated with these elements, you can identify specific interactions. So in this case, A is demonstrated to be interacting with element D and with element B. Okay, and there are certain conventions. Sometimes people will say that the interaction above that diagonal is feed forward, that is to say, A is interacting with element E, and if the network is symmetric, then it doesn't matter, it's just there are mutual connections. But if it's asymmetric, that is to say the X's above the diagonal are different from the X's below the diagonal, then that suggests that there's something that's flowing from one node to another, and maybe that's not reciprocated. Okay. But this diagram, which is relatively easy to read, is essentially the same thing as this diagram, which is quite a bit harder to read. And it turns out that if you convert something into a matrix, there are all sorts of mathematical operations that you can use that are helpful for understanding and manipulating the matrix. So we can use DSMs because these are essentially telling us what the interactions are between different elements of the system. We could then say, well, what is the nature of that interaction? And now you have an interface definition, right? So the interface is where two elements interact. The things touch each other in some way or another, and you can further specify what the nature of that interaction is. By instead of just putting an X in this diagram, you can put a numeric value other than binary. You can also graphically represent the nature of the connections. I'll show you that, an example of that in a moment. So this is a kind of a convenient way to start managing interfaces. So there are a number of things that you can do. For instance, you can sequence or cluster the interactions between different elements in the system. Why would you want to cluster them? Well, so in this case, in this case, you see what are essentially three clusters. One, two, three. And there isn't a lot of stuff going on between these clusters. There aren't any connections that are off the diagonal. So this cluster isn't really interacting with this cluster except through node D. Right? But there are a lot of interactions within a cluster. And that means that that could potentially be a module in your system. And you have a team assigned to that module, and they manage all of those interactions because they're working together closely. And you have maybe fewer opportunities for missing a handoff. You can look at a sequence to say there's a logical order in which some of these things should happen. And yes, there are some interactions forward or backward, depending on the convention you use. And what you want to do is you want to make sure that there, in this case, I think the back flows would be in the upper diagonal. And you don't want to have any information here late in the sequence feeding back into an earlier process. You want to have all of the interactions or information flows or mass flows or whatever feeding forward from earlier processes into later processes. Yep. Morgan, question?
I understand clustering, but practically it doesn't seem like it'd be very useful. Like, how clusters are formed is completely dependent on the sequence of the A, B, C, D, whatever you do. If you put A at the end, you would see a different thing, and you might have a different interface. So how do you practically come up with these clusters?
Good question. So there are actually three primary DSM types. There's a product architecture DSM, and this is components of the system. And if components are touching each other or influencing each other, then you want to cluster them together. You can have a process architecture where you have flows and activities. And you might use that as your organizing construct, where you want to have information flows always happening where you have a flow from an earlier activity flow into a later activity so you don't have any feedback flows. And then you can have an organizational DSM where you're looking at the people and the way that people interact with each other when they communicate. Right? So these are different ways that you can organize clusters. So for instance, you might have people that are all in a design team or in a department because they need to communicate and you might want to locate them closely together. So there are different ways that you can cluster depending on what you want to accomplish. Yes?
I could have a follow-up. That doesn't really answer my question. You said there's different ways you can represent that A, B, C, D, or whatever with components, activities, or people. My concern is that the actual formation of this graph and what looks like a cluster is completely dependent on the sequence of A, B, C, D, regardless of if it represents components or different activities or different people. So how do you pick the sequence so that you can get clusters? Is it arbitrary? Is there some like analog to k-means clustering or something like that that you can use? Like, what are some practical applications other than just picking random sequences and seeing if it seems to look like a cluster.
So there are a number of clustering methods that are available, and I'm not going to go into DSM in detail, but I'll point you to some references. Certainly the components and activities may be correlated to varying degrees, but yes, if you want to look at sequences of events, then you probably want to look at a process for DSM. And there are instances where you look at, say, a design process, and you want to know when should we make a decision to freeze a certain part of the design. Well, that will depend on how mature the technology is, how stable the design is, and the flows of information. So when you get into verification, validation, testing for that design, is it likely that you're going to have some kind of information feedback that will influence an upstream process? So yeah, there is quite a bit. There are a lot of people who have thought about this process of how you use DSMs to define modules and interfaces. Unfortunately, we don't have time to talk about all of those things. But I'll point you to references. You got one chapter out of the Eppinger Brown book. I think it's all the chapters are available online for download. If the DSM analysis is something that you want to look at, then you know there are chapters associated with each of these different types of DSMs, as well as an MDM, which is a multi-domain matrix. So you can actually look at the connection between, say, components and people. So why would you want to know that? Who's working on a specific cluster? You want to know that if there's a problem in that cluster, or if your element interacts with that cluster. Okay? What are the activities that the different people go through? So this is potentially related to your PDP. And what is the sequence of events that people use to design components? How do they map to the architecture of the system? Again, there's a lot to talk about in MDMs. And so if you're interested in this topic, there's more to follow up in papers. Tyson Browning, one of our MIT grads, master's and PhD. Steve Eppinger, professor now retired from Sloan, essentially spent a lot of his career working on DSMs. So a lot of work has been put into this, but stepping back from the details, this is a way to represent the interactions between people, groups, components, and there are some useful mathematical tools that can help you to cluster things or do other manipulations. When we talk about complexity, in the spring, one of the inputs is a DSM or a relationship matrix, because we want to understand how all these parts of a network are connected to one another. So it's a useful tool. Now I will say that in industry, you probably won't see this used very often because it's not commonly written about, it's not commonly used, it's not built into the tools that people use. It's helpful in the discussions that we have because you can represent a network relatively easily. And I'll show you an example in a moment. Build the intuition. How are things connected? Do we want to connect things through a cluster that are closely tied together or related to one another? That's really the benefit that you get from this. Now, if Steve Eppinger were to come in and give one of his lectures on DSMs, and he'd say, well, here's an example where we went into Intel and we helped them understand the process better, and specifically we identified a downstream process that's quite late in the process where test results are variable, they're not easily predicted, and they feed back up to an earlier stage in the process. And so we can use that information to say, well, maybe move the validation activity further upstream so that we can, you know, sever that large feedback loop. As I said, there are a few references available. There's the book. I think you can just, you can probably get this down, you can download it somehow. DSMweb.org is a website that has a lot of discussion about different clustering methods, algorithms that you might want to use. And I think they still have a conference. Check it out. Google is your friend. Thank you, please.
My question is on sequencing for the pre-MRI. So in sequence group, you already have some groups in which the process is closely connected. Mm-hmm. So potentially the connection in the group is very important. That's why you make clear the connection. Mm-hmm. Then give me a check. This time the group. So this is not
the same. Yeah. So again, going back to the sequence of activities or the people, I mean, these are all connected, and you can't connect them to an MDM. But in the sequence of activities, what we would like to do is centralize or localize the activities that provide information to each other. So the thing that you want to avoid in a process is late-breaking information that feeds back into an early process. Because then you go back and you start over again, and that leads to delays. So that's why you want to organize the sequences into clusters as much as you can to avoid these long feedback loops. Did that answer your question? Questions on the line? So feed forward versus feedback.
Yeah, like how these components directionally connect each other.
I've seen it both ways depending on the author. So was there specific guidance in the assigned reading on which one Steve Uttinger prefers or Tyson Browning? Zach, you have your nod in your head?
Yes, there was. I don't think he used the term feed forward, but he said that whatever the interface was in the DSM, the X's to the left and the right were the inputs to that interface.
Yeah.
And then if there was something above or below that was an output, is that feed forward?
Well, I think maybe this thing that I, does this answer the question? No, it doesn't. Skip past it really quick. So let's, on this diagram, describe. So you start off, let's say you start off with a row.
Yep.
Okay?
Yep.
And what is the convention?
So then the convention would be for, let's say we'll start with row A, alpha. There's an interface between Alpha and Charlie, and
yep.
The interaction or interface between Alpha and Echo is an input to that interface.
So Echo is an interface to Alpha?
Correct.
Excuse me, input.
Input. Input to, yep, Alpha, right.
Okay. So in this case, the inputs are on the upper diagonal.
Yes.
To the element in the row.
Yes.
And so this would be feed back.
Okay.
And that's why a lot of these diagrams that I've been showing you try to have an empty upper diagonal.
Okay.
Because you don't want to have feed back. You want to have feed forward.
Okay.
So in this case, element B sends something to element E, which is way in the back, at the end of the line, Mohammed.
I'm sorry, why don't you want to have feedback?
Feed, if you're looking at a sequence diagram,
yeah,
then this means that you've reordered this. It's not A, B, C, D, E, D, you know, through H. It's now B, D, G, F, because you want to have things feeding forward and clustered. And you also don't want to have feedback, because as a sequence, this is the last thing that you do. And you don't want to discover something here that will impact the decision you make up there, because then you've got to start over. Those long feedback loops are schedule killers. Okay. Yep. That is a question.
Yeah, just real quick. I think I actually was thinking about Morgan's question, and this seems to answer it too. It's, you have reordered these letters to create clusters, right? So the idea is, like, the order of the letters isn't canonical, right? You can reorder to get different information out of it.
Yeah, great point, and I'm sorry I missed that. One of the operations you do is reorganize the structure of the matrix so that you achieve these clusters, right? Or, you know, clusters or sequence or whatever. And so you start with this, and maybe you end up with this. Although these are two different examples. Okay. All right, so that's DSM. And again, I would urge you to, you know, if you're really interested, there are tutorials online. There's more reading material. I think this will largely get you through the core, but you may have to do some additional reading, especially if you want to start looking at clustering. Now, in SA, you heard all about modular architectures and how wonderful they are. Well, that's not really what Bruce says, but they are something that you would potentially consider creating, because it solves a lot of problems. But, you know, how are you gonna create those modules? Well, this is one of the ways that people do it. So let's stop here and take a 5-minute break, and we'll pick up again on the interfaces.
You're back.
So what?
You're back.
Yeah, I'm back.
Everybody's right.
I'm actually a certificate, right? So I was going to do the whole thing remote. But because I work remote, I was like, yeah, I was like, you know, let me just see what it's like. Unless I have to go places for work in the spring, I'd like, I think, to be here more full time, like in Boston and Cambridge.
If you're on campus, you might as well change to a master's program, you know, because you're
maybe.
Unless you don't want to.
Yeah, it's like, honestly, it's more like it's mostly just like, could I still do that and keep my job and work? You know, I'd have to do it part-time. How long would that take?
Necessarily.
Yeah.
I'm doing full-time.
Oh, that's... Are you really?
But,
oh, yeah, you were doing like all your classes on Mondays and Wednesdays?
Yeah. So that's the only thing you have to do all around. But you could technically, if you do 12-hour days, that's 36 hours that you've completed in 3 days.
Yeah, that's fair.
And
enough.
Then you do a few hours on the weekends.
If you can get the... And you'll need 2 years still, right?
Right.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah,
you can't do that.
You know, even in class, you know, you can answer emails, you can still be someone.
That's true, yeah.
Necessary.
No, and my work is like pretty flexible for that. So that's kind of... Yeah, I'm kind of like working through the mechanisms of what's possible there. Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, I forgot that you're full-time still there. Yeah. No, I definitely could. And I think that's pretty much also why I wanted to be here, so I could decide before the deadline. I'd probably have to decide by January, essentially, whether I want to matriculate to the master's. But we'll see, yeah. It's definitely tempting. We'll see.
Represent interfaces and then you put them into a matrix and you can use matrix mathematics and random algorithms to help the cluster. But at its basic element, you have functions that are allocated to different elements, and because you've allocated the single function to different elements, you now created some kind of relationship between these elements in order to accomplish those functions. And we tend to capture these relationships in an n-squared diagram or DSM. We also typically, you know, systems engineers create system block diagrams. And this is where you have, here's an element of the system, and here's an arrow that goes from this element to another element, and you can decompose those and have multiple levels of decomposition, and sometimes you forget to put a label on the arrow, and that's really important information. So we want to really kind of capture the information when we define the system so that we can understand what is the nature of that interface and how important is it. So here's an example. This is an electrical outlet. So we have an electrical outlet over there in the corner. It's just a simple one. It's a National Electrical Manufacturers Association NEMA 5. Okay, so it's a specific category. It's 120 volts and it's a 20 amp circuit. It's grounded, but all it does is provide power. So if you look at interfaces through this outlet, the only thing that's going to come through is residential line voltage energy. Okay. This one is a little bit different. It's got some USB ports on it. And you might see these in airports or cafes or something like that, where you want to go in, spend some time, charge up your device before you go somewhere else, or devices. And so we have a USB-A port and a USB-C port. And then there's a chip inside this device that recognizes where you're plugging something in and doesn't send 120 volts to your iPhone, which is good, and doesn't send 5 volts to your laptop charger, which is also good. So the functions this performs, it has to fit into a standard receptacle. And this is, there are standards for where you build buildings. Distributes power in different forms through different connections. So we have the NEMA 5 connection, the USB-A connection, the USB-C connection, and customizes the current flows, and this also has to be tamper resistant because that's part of the electrical code. So we can look at these four canonical types of interfaces. We have a physical connection, we have energy flow, we have mass flow, and we have information flow. Probably not a lot of mass flow in this one. So here's a, excuse me, this is a system block diagram. So you have the system boundary is this device. That's how we're going to define it for this exercise. So the system boundary covers a device which has incoming current. It distributes the current to different things. So coming straight out of the wall, you have 120 volts. It goes to the main NEMA 5 connection. And for these other ones, you want 5 volts. So you have transformer, regulator function, and you have these different supply conduits. Right? And you can represent these in a DSM form easily enough. There are only 6 elements represented here. And we have A1 and A2. So A1 to A2 has energy flow. And A1 to A4, again, another energy flow. And you can assign a specific code to help you identify what is the interaction and the interface between these things. And then we have some information flows, so A3, A5, and A6. So A3 to A5 and A6, the regulator is going to tell you how much current you should send through each of these connections so you don't burn up a device. Right, so that's why information has to flow back and forth between these. Any questions so far?
Yeah. So in this case, why do we also do the physical connections for everything? Is it just because it's too much? Or?
Well, we can. In fact, just ask and I'll do it. So we can look at this. It's also maybe it's helpful to look at the interaction across the system boundary, because that's an interface too, right? You have a device that's connecting to this USB-C supply, and it provides some feedback on how much is too much power and how much is too much voltage and so forth. So the information is specifically about, for this kind of device, is about what is a compatible current and voltage. It's not transferring information, you know, data files and so forth. Okay? And then you can specify the physical connection that exists between genes and models. And you can see that there are quite a few connections that you might care about across that system boundary. So which ones, if you were, and this is a simple example, but if you were designing this device and wanted to stay on top of things, what would you look at? Are there some specific elements of the system that you think you would want to stay on top of? Yes?
I would say the regulate process. Sorry. Because you could fry someone's phones and they'll rip them off.
Okay. So why would you focus on that one? Maybe, what if you just design it once and it's always right?
It just seems more complicated than the rest of it.
Okay. Other ideas about what you might want to focus on?
Connections to the main service might change how they input or regulate or two-phase or three-phase.
Yeah. Okay. So connection to the mains. Stephen, you had a comment? Yes, no?
Oh, I was going to say the same thing because, like, typically if you're making the product that's within the system battery, you're not the one who's providing power from the main system. And so you'll have two different entities that have to, like, engage and talk to each other.
Okay. O'Shane, what would you want to pay attention to?
And also, when we have multiple stuff plugged in, like, for example, all the ports are plugged in, we want to make sure there's enough of the power transmitted and provided, including the voltage as well as the amp.
Okay, good. So let's think about this in terms of, you covered with Bruce, and I think I covered a little bit, rate of technological change, and there's a discussion about S-curves and things like that. So maybe one of the things you'd want to look at is, you know, what is the useful life of this design? Is anything here changing at a rate where it might become obsolete? Yep. You had it. Hand up. Yes.
I think USB, it can go or fashion.
Okay. So USB might change. The electrical code and the NEMA standards are pretty stable. Now they'll change from country to country, but those standards have been around for decades. And electrical code will change, but typically not on supply voltage. So you can say that's probably pretty. This leg of the loop is pretty stable. USB-A has been around for quite a while, and there are standards, and they've evolved over time, but a lot of that evolution happened 20 years ago. But USB-C and things that are related, so Apple just reluctantly agreed to change from Thunderbolt to USB-C because Europe said you can't sell your devices here. It's within the last year. Right, so, and USB-C is kind of evolving. So that would probably be something that maybe you assign an engineer to be part of the working group for that standard, because that's an interface that might change and you want to make sure your device is compatible with other things. Otherwise, this is a pretty straightforward device. It is itself an interface to many different things, from a power supply to a lot of different devices. And devices are always changing. So, you know, what are the standards for, you know, how much current is acceptable current? Okay? Any questions? Bosheng, you had your hand up?
Yeah, thank you, Professor. Just a quick thing, linking back to what we covered in SA, there's a rule 7 ± 2. So when we're doing this, do we also follow that rule? And if yes, I noticed that we came around that number by design, which means the people arbitrarily pick the number, or is it actually because the system is so simple and there are so many components in total?
Yeah, so that's a good question. So 7 ± 2 really kind of gets to the hierarchical nature of our decomposition systems. So we don't have to keep track of too many things at a given level of the hierarchy, and then we tend to allocate functions or interfaces down to the next level as appropriate. Okay, in something like this, we have 10. So this is a 10 by 10, 100 different possible connections. Actually, it's 9 n × n−1, if you don't count the diagonal. So we have 90 different things we can keep track of, but this is not fully populated, right? And most systems that you look at are not going to be fully populated. But because you have it's n squared, essentially, is the number of possible connections you could have. You want to differentiate between the ones that are straightforward and you just allocate them to designers or the discipline engineers, and there are some things that you as a systems engineer want to keep track of. This is a simple example. We could maybe find one example of an interface that you want to keep track of just because it's the technology is moving along, but not a lot of examples here. And mostly these are things that you just say, okay, we'll let the discipline people take care of this because it's well within their wheelhouse to handle this kind of an interface. As you go through, you may adopt some kind of nomenclature to handle this. So you want to be able to identify each of the interfaces separately, give it a name, what is its purpose or rationale, you have source and destination, the two sides of an interface, what is being passed along. You might have some standards that you're working to and you want to document those as well. Right, so there are a number of different, so you could have use cases, say, okay, under this situation you have this kind of transfer across the interface. So you can get this to be as detailed as you want, and then if you have a large number of interfaces, then you probably want to rely on some kind of application to help you. So modern model-based systems engineering tools are really well suited for this kind of activity, keeping track. So you define the system diagram, you define the arrow, you have a data element that's assigned to that arrow, and you can then connect it to the interface description. And as you allocate through the system hierarchy, you have a record of all of the interfaces, and you can assign them to a specific person if you need to. And again, you as a systems engineer will want to just keep track of a small number of those because they have system level implications. Here's an example. This is a big copy machine from Xerox. This was one of Professor Eppinger's. Actually, this is Professor DeBeck. And Professor Su is Korean Institute of Technology now, one of all his students. So they looked at these flows in this copy machine. So this is an 84x84 DSM. And you can see that there's a user interface, there's the feeder for paper, there's a print engine, there's a marking path, there's a control path, and so forth. So there's a lot of things going on here. And you can designate each of these as mass flow. So paper would be mass flow through the system, toner would be mass flow. Information, the sensor is going to send information to the marker. and so forth. All right, and then they also have some things like byproducts. So you can have interfaces that are unintentional. So as this is going through its operation, it's probably going to produce a lot of heat, right? And it's going to produce a lot of vibration. And those are going to interact through components to other components. And so maybe you want to have, as an interface, an insulation blanket that prevents the transfer of heat, or a vibration damper that prevents the transfer of vibration. So not all interfaces are good ones, but they can also be consequential. But you have 84 by 84, the number of connections, physical connections 572, mass flow connections 45, and so forth. The total number of blank cells in this is over 27, almost 28,000, and the number of non-empty cells is only 1,000. So the sparsity, or non-zero cells, is a little less than 4%. And this is probably what you're going to see in a system, typically, is single-digit population. So fortunately, not a lot of interfaces, but there are 1,000 that you would maybe keep track of, but not all of them are ones that you as a system engineer would want to worry about. Now, this sparsity actually depends on the architecture of your system, how many modules you define, what the interactions between the modules are. In some cases, you pay a penalty for having connections. In other cases, the connections are kind of cost-free or of low, very low cost. So your sparsity in, say, a software system might be different from a hardware system or in a physical system. And we'll talk a little bit more about topology of architectures when we meet in the spring to discuss complexity. Yes, question.
So the total number of DSM elements are 84. So the number of base DSM cells should be 84 across 83.
Well, it's going to be 84 by 84, but you ignore the diagonal elements.
Yeah, so for that we will get 83. It should be much less than 27,972.
Okay, well, that's probably because these are multiplied by four, because you have four different types of connections that you're monitoring. Okay. Aladdin, question?
With this is on clusters of the diagonal, what do those mean? Like, how can we make sense or interpret the clusters that happen outside of the diagonal?
Yeah. So when you have clusters that are outside of the diagonal, you can't bring into the main clusters of the architecture. What you often do with those is you'll create a bus or a system level service or function. All right. So the frame and the control path are things that affect many different elements of the system. You might see those as being kind of a system level service. And you would probably have a team assigned to those, and a large part of their job is to interface with the other modules in the system. So they're gonna make sure that all the things integrate properly at the final system level, okay?
Okay. Yes, Professor. It appears that there's some sort of a physical decomposition and functional decomposition, and a tracing between those two in our architecture has done before creating this matrix. So I'm assuming that this could be one of the way the Morgan was asking how to kind of understand these interfaces and their sequences. So is it the right interpretation that we need some sort of a basic physical functional decomposition before diving into a DSM of interface?
That's a good question. I had a discussion with Morgan during the book about this. A lot of the examples, the cases that you'll see of DSMs are examples where a DSM of an existing system is being created and then studied. And the question is, how can we make sense of this system and its architecture, and how can we maybe come up with a better way forward? So I gave the example of the process at Intel for designing a chip that Professor Eppinger uses. So he goes into Intel and they have an existing process and he's collecting data based on that process, and you create a DSM and you make sense of what's happening. You can observe and diagnose and say, hey, maybe you should form this team and maybe you should do this activity at a different point in the sequence. So this is an existing product. So that's kind of the same thing. Somebody already went through that form and function decomposition. And if you go in and you create a DSM of an existing product, then you're going to essentially be in a position to correct somebody else's mistakes. Now, if you're starting with a brand new product, you can try to avoid those mistakes by selecting modules or sequences or other things that minimize the potential for missed handoffs. And so you'll, excuse me, in the work that you're doing in the core and in future OSs, have the opportunity with a clean sheet system to say, okay, what's the right structure for this architecture that helps me to avoid problems either with the execution of the program or the design of the system or the sequence of operations. All right, so here's an example of actually designing an interface. Now this is a novel obstructive sleep apnea device. Basically, if you have sleep apnea, you're probably waking up tens or hundreds of times a night, and you don't get very good rest. And so the question is, how can you? And it's because your pathways between the holes in your head and the lungs get blocked partially, and so it's a big problem. And people who have sleep apnea they're just tired all the time. So the dominant solution is to wear what's called a CPAP mask. Looks kind of like an alien xenomorph. It's attached itself to your face, and it makes a lot of noise and it's uncomfortable. And there are debates about whether that's actually the remedy is better than the original problem. Some people thought, we should just have this little thing that goes inside your mouth and it creates this mild suction and it essentially pulls your mouth shut so that you're breathing through your nose, and that supposedly makes it easier. Now, if you want to do it on the cheap, you can just tape your mouth shut, but the studies are mixed on whether that actually works. So anyhow, here's this idea, a new product. Let's design the system that has a part that fits in your mouth. It has a suction tube, a generator, and a monitor, and it's easy to use. Okay? So this is a DSM of this device. We have the mouth guard stuff up there. You have a vacuum suction pump. This has been already clustered to a degree. We have the pressure sensor, and we have a bunch of control functions in here because you want to make sure you get this right. You don't want to have a bad experience for the user. Right? And then you have the electrical connections. Right? So what would you expect to focus on interfacing around here? Any tip-offs? Are some interfaces more important than others? Muhammad?
Just from looking at DSM, usually the most important interfaces are either at the beginning or the end of the DSM kind of, so either in the first grouping or the first columns, and the last columns and rows as well.
Okay.
Have your most important.
So, is a vote for the first things and the last things. Others? Ideas about where we might focus our attention there. Andrew?
In between the clusters, because that's where subsystems might be connecting.
Okay, so definitely where you have major subsystems connecting, you want to focus on that, right? Okay? Other, Jameson?
I would probably focus on the spots where the system interacts with the person. Because that pressure sensor and suction cup, I think, are going to be places where the human interacts with it, which is the highest likelihood of causing damage that would sort of ruin our technology or ruin our company. Mm-hmm. And so that would be, I'd focus there.
Yeah. Okay. So the human-machine interface. Okay. So let's look at this. So we have the pressure sensor module is very complicated, very linked. So we want to focus on that. And that is the, right up here, this cluster here. And it's linked to the communications module. You can see a lot of off-diagonal elements there. And so you'd want to monitor. If you had those broken up into two different teams, you'd want to have someone assigned to make sure that one team was not doing something another team would regret. That's one of the kind of guidelines for how you would manage something like this. Now, these other areas, you have these electrical connectors that are connected to things, but those are fairly straightforward interfaces. You define the connectors and maybe you allocate that to a discipline engineer and it doesn't have a huge system implication. But the functionality that resides in the pressure sensor or the communications module has enough complexity that you could expect or anticipate some emergent behavior, or you have multiple operating modes that you want to control and make sure that there's a positive outcome. Now also, because this, I don't know if this would be registered as an FDA device or not, but there may be some regulatory requirements for documenting the interfaces. Okay. So, generally speaking, interfaces can be good, they can be a source of value in the system. So like in the case of the electric power plug, the interface provides value by allowing you to charge multiple devices at once. But it can also, that value doesn't come for free. And the way it usually manifests itself is in terms of extra weight or extra complexity or extra cost. And I'll show you some examples of that. So you really, when you're looking at maybe adding interfaces, and this applies if you're going to create a modular architecture, which by definition has interfaces that are defined, you have to do a trade-off of whether the benefit that you get from those additional interfaces is worth the penalty that you pay. If you are operating at the performance margins of technologies in your system, you probably want to avoid interfaces, because they are parasitic. They will take some of your performance away. And you may not be able to achieve your system performance if you have those interfaces. So you come up with a more integrated architecture. If, on the other hand, you have good performance margins, performance to spare, then you can afford to pay those penalties at the interface. And you put in the interface, and maybe there's some other benefits that outweigh the loss in performance. But these are the sorts of trade-offs that you as a systems engineer want to be involved in. Do we have an integral architecture? Do we have a modular architecture, a distributed architecture? And what is the overall impact for our system? A lot of you will have heard that common interfaces are a good thing. They allow modular design, so you can have components that share an interface. You can have fabrication to fit modularity. You can mix different parts if they have common interfaces. You can create buses. So like in a car, you have a CAN bus, a communication bus, that you connect all these different components to, or Ethernet buses. And then you can have different sections that you put together. So the combination of all these different things is kind of like Lego blocks. You can create a lot of different varieties of products by mixing and matching these interfaces. So you have economies of scale and you have got economies of scope. But here's a cautionary example. This is the Google Aura modular cell phone project. Anybody heard of the Google Aura project? Yeah, a few of you, okay. So the idea was, what if you raise your hand? Can you tell me what the idea was behind this device? Yep, Sophie?
Yeah, I believe the concept was that you could, by modularizing components of your phone, you could only select the components that were of most use to you, mm-hmm. spending more money to upgrade a camera or a battery, and then removing features that you didn't use so that you either had a smaller or cheaper or more compact device.
Yeah, so what's not to like about that? So you have this frame, and you plug these modules in. The modules have a standardized size, so you have to make sure you get the right size modules. But you plug them into your phone, and you can customize it. And you know, if you're just looking for a phone, maybe this is not so compelling. But if you were a scientist or a physician, and you needed to have a specific type of sensor in your phone, wouldn't that be great, right? Or some other functionality that is just really not common to cell phones. So. Who knows how big the market is? Maybe you're an enthusiast and you want to have the fastest processor you can find. Every time the processor comes out, you slot that in. Well, potentially you can have aftermarkets for trading these components. You eliminate electronic waste. That's a good thing. And it's cheap. So there are a lot of compelling reasons to embrace this concept. Well, it turns out that these cell phones, at least at the level of performance we expect from them, are really operating at the margins. Okay, they're operating at the margins of their CPU capacity, they're operating at the margins of their battery capacity, and when you start adding interfaces, plus just the frame itself, because a lot of the things that are in a phone are really integrated tightly into the frame. You end up with a phone that is too heavy, battery doesn't last long enough, and so the trade-offs were too great for the consumer market, and eventually the project was canceled. We had a group here at MIT that was studying this problem, and it was definitely, they were operating at the margins of technology, and they couldn't afford the cost that the interfaces were imposing on the phone. So if you find yourself in an industry where that's the case, you're probably going to be driven towards integrated architectures, just so you can squeeze the last drop of performance out of the system. Okay. So we talked a bit about interfaces as a source of value. Let me give you another example. Service-based systems. Okay, this is a system that provides a service to me, but I don't own the capability. And you can imagine a lot of online services, banking, retail, navigation. These are things where I don't own the way in which the service is provided to me. But I enjoy it, and I enjoy it through a service interface. And there are people who spend a lot of time worrying about what the nature of that interface is, so that the customers come back and they're happy and they keep providing revenue. So a lot of thought goes into the design of these interfaces because they provide functionality that's valuable. But we've talked about the potential challenges, and what are some of the challenges? Well, you've got interfaces and you don't pay attention to them. That's probably going to lead to some problems down the road. Right? You don't resource them enough, you don't put the people on, you don't have responsibility for those interfaces. You don't account for the way that those interfaces may evolve over time. So we talked about the USB standard has evolved over time. And for something as simple as an outlet charger, that could have implications for your product. So you need to stay on top of that. And then you have abnormal operating conditions, things that are outside of the assumptions that you used when you designed that interface. And hopefully your operational analysis will help you to understand what the range of operating conditions are, but those are part of the interface. Human-machine interface, I word that with the ATM. Well, let's go back. HMI is one of the most important and underappreciated, according to the HMI engineers, disciplines there is. So if you've ever seen the cockpit of an airplane, you often see a lot of levers and a lot of dials, and sometimes levers have funny shapes on them, like there's a wheel on the lever that retracts and deploys the landing gear. So it's intuitive. You grab the wheel if you want the wheels to go down. There's some levers that have flaps, you know, like the flaps on the wings, so you deploy them. This is the work of human-machine interface people. So here's an example. In 2013, during the holiday shopping season, Target, a major retailer in the U.S., had a data breach, and they compromised 40 million credit card numbers during this data breach. And this is a story about interfaces. So they were compliant with the payment card industry data security standard. They met all of the requirements for the technology that they use to keep credit cards safe. But hackers got into the point of sale network and they installed skimmers. They scraped the information that's being transmitted through this network. And it turns out that all of the Target web servers and processing system was met the requirements of the security standard. They had a heating, ventilation, air conditioning, and plumbing contractor that was tied into their system. And somebody sent a phishing attack to the vendor that provided basic, you know, services, but they also build the Target, so they had some connection to the financial system. And the employee at the HVAC vendor fell for the phishing scam and provided username and password, and with that they were in, and they were able to scrape the information. And they were really clever because they used the operating cycle of the system. So during peak hours when there were a lot of transactions, they would download the information that they had scraped from the database, and it just looked like there was a lot of activity going on. So, you know, certainly a combination of clever hackers who had access to some pretty basic technology, but also a bad human-machine interface. An interaction between, or an interface between a vendor and the main data structure at Target led to this compromise of a lot of these names. And this is not just a pick on Target. There are a lot of attacks, security compromises that happen this way because there is an interface there that somebody, and we call them backdoors, there's an interface that somebody was not paying attention to. All right, so let's move on. So you as a system engineer need to understand, okay, what are the system level interfaces that will be something that you want to pay attention to? And the sleep apnea device example is an indicator of things where you have those off-diagonal elements or interfaces that connect different modules in the system. Okay? That would be kind of a tip-off that maybe you should look at that one a little bit more closely. Interfaces that involve multiple actors, especially if they are outside of your organization. Because if you have multiple actors, you have multiple, potentially multiple intents. And if they have different intentions than you do, or different assumptions, then there's a possibility that you might misunderstand what is supposed to transact at that interaction. And if you have these external interfaces, you know, at the system boundary, then you may have a contractual obligation to provide an interface control document. Certainly it's good practice. Or the working with the vendors, suppliers, partners, create an interface control document. The ICD also can potentially serve other purposes. So let's say you have important intellectual property that you want to protect. You want to create as generic an interface as possible so you don't have a complicated relationship that requires people to start understanding what you're doing inside your black box, inside your system boundary. And so there's some strategy in defining interfaces across those organizational lines for reasons because of intellectual property, legal liability, things like that. Okay, so I think we've had a bunch of discussions so far, so I'm unfortunately going to skip this. This is an opportunity for you to share interfaces, but I think you've got a recitation coming up that's going to talk about. Is that right? Is that tomorrow? Mm-hmm. Yeah, so tomorrow, keep these questions in mind. What are some interfaces that you've worked in the past that turned out to be really important, and why were they important? They lead to product failures, warranty claims, security compromises, schedule slip, you know, any of those reasons. What was your experience with those managing those interfaces, and what do you think you might have done differently? And so that's a big part of the recitation tomorrow. Okay. So I'm going to quickly go through interface control documents. Or actually interface documents and processes, but I'm going to do this quickly. It's in the slides, it's straightforward, it's part of standards. I don't think we need to belabor it, but you'll have an interface requirements document. So often, when we go through the requirements development process, we will create performance, system requirements, functional requirements, and interface requirements. Okay, and it tells you what has to happen at an interface. Interface control document, the ICD, is what actually documents that and documents the solution. And this is this could be a contract deliverable, in fact, to have that interface control document, or it could be the foundation for a contract if you're working with a supplier. Here's some examples of interface control documents. So you have the requirement is that system one will obtain power from system, system two will obtain power from system one, and refer to this document and the drawing, okay? And, but then you go to that document and the drawing, and it tells you what the pin layout and so forth, and grounding information. So this is the actual solution. So you have a requirement in the ICD, but the ICD is the one you typically are tracking. They may be part of the technical deliverables. Digital models, systems engineering applications are designed to help you to compose these documents, typically, so that you give it the information for the interface, and then it can create the ICD and all of the different elements. We went over interface descriptions and requirements, you would capture those, but you could also do some modeling to see if the interface is actually going to work the way that you want it to do. And then finally, you're tying into the verification validation process. So you want, if you have an interface control document or an interface requirement, it has to be tied into the V&V process, which we'll cover on Wednesday. This is part of a technical management process at NASA or in many other places. That means it's something that is going on continuously. So given the time, I'm going to just skip through some of these slides. We would perform the interface analysis, so we went through that. I showed you with the outlet how you might identify and define interfaces. Capture the requirements in the documents, develop the definitions, flow them down to the next level. Okay, this is all part of the interface control and also the configuration management process that you use in your organization, where you want to keep track of all these things and who's responsible for them. And then you define the verification activities. Okay, how are we going to verify that this interface has actually been satisfied? And then you tie up by doing the verification, go up to integration and so forth until you have the final report. So let me just summarize. Again, the big idea for today is that interfaces are handoffs, and handoffs are challenging, and so you want to have a formal process for managing these interactions. Identify the interfaces, identify which ones have system-level implications, IP, security, other things, working with other groups or organizations, and then thinking about the design. What kind of interfaces are going to help our system performance or the user experience that we have with our system? And that's it. So we'll see you on Wednesday to talk about V&V, and then we can learn more about and share with one another the various pieces of the interface and the presentation.
See you, buddy.